Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
When grad student Emet St. Guillen was murdered last year outside a Manhattan nightclub, the media and policymakers focused primarily on the club scene for reform. Her alleged killer was a bouncer, you remember. In a tragic twist, the new club crackdown led to the death of Sean Bell outside a Queens club last November. But a new book suggests that there was another root cause of St. Guillen's murder, one that has gone largely ignored by the criminal justice system and the media. The harsh drug laws in the United States that inspire witnesses to cooperate, to snitch, as many people call it, to avoid endless time in prison for themselves for relatively low-level crimes. Ironically, though, all this snitching winds up with some really dangerous criminals on the street, including Daryl Littlejohn, the accused killer of Emet St. Guillen. So can snitching on criminals really lead to more dangerous streets? My next guest is convinced it does. He is journalist Ethan Brown, whose new book is called Snitch, Informants, Cooperators, and the Corruption of Justice, published by Public Affairs Books. Ethan, thanks for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Let's begin with the Emet St. Guillen murder. You discovered that her accused killer, Daryl Littlejohn, had been a snitch, a cooperating witness in a case in the 1990s. What was that case?
Well, actually, he was, it's interesting, he was an informant for the Nassau County DA's office first in an armed robbery case in the late 90s. And then soon afterward, he was a cooperating witness in a very similar case in the federal system, a very similar armed robbery case.
And what was his role? Because you think Daryl Littlejohn should have been behind bars at the time that he killed Emet St. Guillen, don't you?
Yeah, well, you know, his role in the initial armed robbery in the Nassau County case was that, you know, he played a central role in this armed robbery, and he was facing something like 10 years, and because of his informant agreement, didn't serve that time. It's much less clear what his role was in the federal armed robbery case. And I've actually spoken with some of the some of his co-defendants in that case, and you know, they essentially believe that he sort of fabricated out of whole cloth his role in the case and the role of others, other co-defendants.
And fabricated evidence is part of the pattern you see here in this culture of cooperation, and we'll get to that. But this Littlejohn case is part of a pattern, and that's the heart of your book. You say the justice system favors defendants who know how to play something called the 5K game. Tell our listeners, what's the 5K game?
Well, the 5K game refers to something called Section 5K1.1 of the Federal Sentencing Guidelines, which essentially says that if you provide, quote, substantial assistance to prosecutors in a case, if you cooperate, you can receive a downward departure from the sentencing guidelines. So, you know, when you're facing very significant sentences in the federal system, one of the central ways to get the downward departures to cooperate. So that is called, you know, often on the streets, the 5K game. You're going after that 5K departure from the guidelines.
So you write that there's a cottage industry of cooperators stemming from this 5K 1.1 of the sentencing guidelines.
Right.
And this yields a lot of fabricated evidence, and therefore not only criminals going free before they should, but more innocent people behind bars.
Right, and I think what's key here is not so much that I'm saying, you know, cooperators are bad people or snitches are bad people, because we know the management of informants and cooperators is a nightmare because, you know, you are dealing with criminals. What I'm saying is that essentially this is a sort of unregulated, unfettered kind of system in which uncorroborated cooperator testimony is allowed in the courtroom, and there are very often no consequences for cooperators who perjure themselves on the witness stand. So yes, there is a problem with the cooperators themselves, but the bigger problem is the system, which is, you know, a largely unregulated system.
My guest, journalist Ethan Brown, author of the book Snitch, Informants, Cooperators, and the Corruption of Justice, and we can take phone calls for him. Any police officers, prosecutors, defense attorneys, anyone else want to call in concerned with public safety and the culture of collaboration, 212-433-WNYC, judges on how these federal sentencing guidelines perhaps hamstring you or encourage the wrong kind of cooperation that might actually make the streets less safe? Or do you disagree with Ethan Brown? We'll quote him from a U.S. senator who does in just a minute. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post a comment to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show for our comments page. So, Ethan, there's at least one paradox here that I'm having some trouble with. You think softer drug laws, lighter sentences for drug crimes, would actually wind up with more dangerous criminals behind bars. Do I have that right?
No, not exactly. What I'm saying is that the, you know,
because you have a problem with the drug laws, right?
Yeah, I do. I think that, you know, when the guidelines were passed, and specifically when the mandatory minimum sentences were passed in the mid to late 80s, they, you know, established extraordinarily severe punishments, specifically for crimes related to crack cocaine trafficking. Those punishments were 100 times more severe than those related to powder cocaine. Now, that has been changed recently by the Sentencing Commission, but you know, and the other problem with the guidelines is I think that they're far too mechanistic. They don't really give a lot of judicial discretion. And in fact, actually, there was a big Supreme Court decision recently in which it was ruled that, you know, that judges could depart from the guidelines. They should be considered advisory rather than mandatory, because, you know, judicial discretion had been curtailed far too greatly.
So you're concerned with some people getting out on the streets too quickly, like Dara Littlejohn, after they collaborate, after being accused of a violent crime like armed robbery.
Right.
But at the same time, you want more discretion, really more lighter sentences for kind of ordinary nonviolent drug offenses, correct?
Right. It's not necessarily lighter sentences. It's more just sentences. I don't think people understand that, you know, someone can do life in prison without parole simply based on drug offenses and in a case where they're not charged with any violent acts. So it's not soft sentences or short sentences necessarily. It's just simply more fair sentences.
Let's take a call from a retired NYPD lieutenant, Steve in Brooklyn. Steve, you're on WNYC. Thanks a lot for calling us.
You're welcome. I don't understand the point of the book or what your guest is trying, the point he's trying to make. I spent my whole life in the narcotics division, and you cannot make case one without an informant. You can do street-level buy-and-bust operations, but the reality is you're only as good as your informants. If you don't have informants, you're not going up that ladder. You're not going to take the higher drug dealers out. All you're going to be dealing with is people on the street. In NYPD, your guest said before, there's no organized manner in which to handle informants, but that's totally untrue. In NYPD, we have very, very strict guidelines about the use of informants, how they can be used, who can be an informant. Any history of violence in the background, you can't be an informant in a narcotics division at all. I don't care what you have. If you've done an armed robbery or you have an assault one, you're not going to be an informant at NYPD.
Ethan?
Yeah, well, I'll take a number of things that you said sort of piece by piece. Number one, yes, there are informant guidelines, and my book focuses primarily on the federal system, and yes, there are informant guidelines in the federal system. But, you know, a recent study by the DOJ Inspector General found that those guidelines were violated 85% of the time. Yes, informants are a critical tool in building all sorts of prosecutions, from, as you say, drug cases to public corruption cases. But, you know, again, I'm speaking, you know, specifically of the federal system. You know, uncorroborated.
If I may, for one moment. The federal system has 1/1,000th of the informants that the local municipalities have. I worked in the Drug Enforcement Task Force, which is a federal task force that has NYPD and state troopers in it, New York state troopers. They have a small fraction of the informants that are used across this country. The vast majority of informants, are in local municipalities.
That's right, and as you probably know,
we're not under those guidelines.
Wait,
under the municipalities'
hang on.
Guidelines.
There have been in state and local enormous scandals among state and local law enforcement involving informants in Tulia and in Texas and Hearn, Texas, where people are trapped and set up by informants. So that it's not true to say that, you know, this is a problem free. Mm-hmm. System at the state and local level. It's not true at all.
Yeah. Steve, can I ask you, what about the Little John case that we cited as an example of snitches who are actually violent criminals who get sent back on the streets too quickly as a result of their cooperation, perhaps resulting in less public safety? Do you think that's an issue at all?
Not in NYPD, it's not. And not in New York City, and I'll tell you why. I mean, it's right in the guidelines. You cannot sign up an informant in this city without a copy of their rap sheet. If their rap sheet has any violence on it, he's not going to be registered as an informant. Mm. My supervisors won't allow it. The district attorney's office will not allow it. It just does not happen. Not here.
Right.
Now, are you going to have corrupt police officers using informants? Well, I mean, the police departments are an anachronism of the entire world. I mean, you're going to have corrupt people anyplace. That doesn't mean that the informant process should be done away with.
I'm not arguing that at all. I'm saying it needs to be reformed. I'm not arguing that the informant process needs to be done away with. I'm saying it needs reform, particularly at the federal level. That's really the sole basis of my argument. I'm not saying informants need to be done away with. I'm saying we need to rein in informants. If we remember, you know, the informant guidelines at the federal level came out of the sprawling abuses that happened with informants in the 1960s. When they were used in the Klan and used to infiltrate the civil rights movement, that was a reform of the informant process. It wasn't a doing away of that process.
Steve, I'm going to leave it there and move on. Thanks a lot for calling us. And Bannon, Manhattan, you're on WNYC with journalist Ethan Brown, author of Snitch. Hello.
Hello, Brian. I just wanted to say about 6 years ago, I was arrested on a marijuana possession charge. And the very first thing that the cop said to me was, "Where did you get it? And who did you get it from?" And at that moment, I was aware that I was choosing between sort of snitching on the guy who sold it to me, knowing that that could imperil my own safety. I know the guy, like, drove around with a machete underneath his front seat.
Mm-hmm.
And if I cooperated with the cops, or I should say if I didn't cooperate with the cops and kept my mouth shut, I might have faced a serious charge that would have put me in jail for some time. And I think every time someone gets arrested and charged with a drug crime, they face a similar situation where they put themselves at the mercy of either a violent criminal or a criminal justice system that tends to put people in jail for a terribly long time.
So, Ethan, are you advocating that somebody in the position that Ben was in should not finger the guy who sold him the drugs?
No, that's not what I'm saying at all. And in fact, his story is fairly familiar, and it kind of leads me to a point that your previous caller made of, quote, going up the ladder.
Mm-hmm.
The way our drug laws are structured, particularly at the federal level, where the drug quantities are very small, and these drug laws essentially target small to mid-level dealers, you know, you're not going up the ladder in this informant process quite often. It's, you know, a retail-level dealer is grabbed by the feds, and he just simply turns on another retail-level dealer because, you know, you can make a case that way because the guidelines allow you to do that. So I think it's a myth. You know, we'd like to believe that, you know, we could go up the ladder and take down, you know, big drug organizations, but that's not what happens. And another reason why that doesn't happen is that we have a system of drug enforcement that's essentially based on weight, drug weights, and not really the criminal behavior. And big time drug dealers aren't going to be caught with the drug weight. So a lot of time it's the little fish in this process that are caught, and the big fish sort of avoid prosecution.
Ben, any last thing to say based on your experience?
Yeah, I'd say that moment, it's so frightening because you sort of see the menacing face of the police officer with his gun or his baton, and you also, on the other hand, imagine the menacing face of whoever got you the stuff, and you can imagine terrifying outcomes in both ways. So it's
what did you do, and do you think you did the right thing?
I kept my mouth shut, and I was lucky to be in a state where the punishments were relatively light, but I know that in a different state, I might have still been in jail. So certainly with the guests in terms of reforming some of these sentences.
Did you ever have any guilt over the fact that by not informing, you let the guy with the machete under his seat keep doing his thing?
No, I think the fact that dealers often have weapons is a reflection of a black market trade. You know, the minute we allow the trade in these substances to come out from the shadows, you won't have people shooting each other up over control of the trade.
Ben, thanks for calling.
Thank you, Brian.
By the way, Ethan, do you watch The Wire?
Yes.
On HBO? Because seems like in that series, you know, the only way the cops ever really make a bust is through a snitch, and that it's the bad cops who don't use informants or snitches.
Well, no, actually, it's interesting that you mentioned The Wire, because I was rewatching season 4 again last night, and if you recall, there's a whole back and forth between the guy who's running the sort of major crimes unit and this new guy takes over and forces these cops to do all these little drug arrests, which he calls street rips, and they really result in nothing. And it kind of shows you that kind of drug enforcement of targeting low to mid-level dealers just really leads you nowhere.
We'll continue in a minute with Ethan Brown, author of the book Snitch. Subtitle is Informants, Cooperators, and the Corruption of Justice. We'll take more of your phone calls at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, and we'll talk about how this ties in to his last book, which you may know, that was Queens Reigns Supreme, about the rise of gangster rap culture in Southeast Queens. So stay with us, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and check out our new podcast, Digesting Politics. From now through Super Duper Tuesday, WNYC political director Andrea Bernstein and I are sitting down over lunch once a week and talking about the campaign. Now, Digesting Politics is a web-only feature that you won't hear on the radio, so sign up for Digesting Politics, the podcast, for free at WNYC.org. Click on Vote 2008. We continue now with journalist Ethan Brown, whose new book is called Snitch, Informants, Cooperators, and the Corruption of Justice, published by Public Affairs Books. And Ethan, as I mentioned before the break, your last book was Queens Reigns Supreme, Fat Cat, 50 Cent, and the Rise of the Hip-Hop Hustler, about the rise of gangster rap culture in Southeast Queens and the flashy drug dealers who dominated the scene. So you don't want to glorify that lifestyle, obviously. But was that all before this 5K1 law got passed?
No, actually. What's interesting and what led me to do the second book partially is that the death of, actually the murder of a police officer named Edward Byrne in New York City at the hands of henchmen working for a drug kingpin in Queens named Lorenzo Fat Cat Nichols actually inspired the passing of some of the drug legislation that I'm talking about, specifically the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1988, which established a 5-year mandatory minimum for mere possession of 5 grams of crack.
Let's just go to another call. Susie in the West Village, you're on WNYC. Hello, Susie.
Hi. My question really has to do with this whole system seems inherently corrupt. If you were to pay somebody cash for testimony, it would be, I presume, illegal, and yet you're paying them with years of their life, clearly more valuable than virtually anything you could offer. How is this legal?
I agree. I mean, I think there's an interesting kind of inherent conflict there. You know, when you are offering, you know, drastic sentence reductions, and I do think, as you say, one's life is certainly measurably much more important than money. And again, this is why we need, you know, regulation of the system. This is why we need to have cooperator testimony corroborated. I'm not calling for the end of the use of informants or cooperators.
Why not?
Because I do think that they do have some value in the system.
Would you be in favor of paying people for their testimony?
What's that? I'm sorry?
Would you be in favor of paying people cash for testimony?
Well, actually, informants, there is a difference. Informants, government informants often are paid for their work. And a cooperator is someone who, you know, cooperates with the government after they are charged. An informant is someone who has an ongoing relationship with the government, and very often that person is compensated monetarily for that.
And we should make that distinction clear, because there are really two different categories of people who you're talking about, and they may have gotten a little bit muddled in this conversation. Informants who can't have violent crimes on their rap sheets, as the retired police lieutenant who called was saying.
That's not necessarily true at the federal level, and I'm not even sure if that's true in other states and in localities. But
one is an informant who's kind of doing it, might be doing it as a job or for whatever reason.
Exactly.
A registered informant, and the cooperating witnesses, like our caller Ben, who can get reduced sentences when they're being charged with something.
Yes, offering information.
That's
to
right.
Prosecutors. Exactly.
You know, the don't snitch movement usually gets discussed in some very different ways than we've been discussing it here. For one thing, many people see it as part of the twisted gangster culture that glorifies thugs and vilifies the police. Do you think it is that also?
I do. And, you know, I think the stop snitching phenomenon is complicated. And I actually have a chapter in my book where I went down to Baltimore to interview the guy who actually created the Stop Snitching DVD that started this whole kind of Stop Snitching trend or movement. And, you know, he said it was interesting that, you know, he made the DVD because the streets were sort of rife with snitches. And he wanted to get this DVD out there to sort of bring awareness to that. And what's interesting about that is that law enforcement and the media interpreted the DVD as basically this enforcement of a code of silence, when it was sort of the opposite. It was sort of a complaint that the code of silence had been broken and it needed to be returned.
Really? Well, let's see if another retired police officer sees it that way. Nick in Seacliff, you're on WNYC. Hello, Nick.
Hi, Brian. Great show as always.
Thank you.
First of all, I got a question actually about the background of your guest. I'd like to know what his educational or work experience background is as it relates to the topic.
what's my educational and work experience?
Yeah, I'm curious as to what your background is.
Well, I've been writing about street crime and criminal justice policy for about 10 years.
Okay.
And my first book, you know, Queens Reign Supreme, was published by Random House in 2005, and it was a several year investigation into a gigantic money laundering case in New York in the federal system.
Okay. All right, well, it sounds like you have some background. Now, concerning the lieutenant that called earlier, he made some very valid points. Now, I wasn't with the NYPD. I was with the DA's office. I was a supervising detective.
Right.
And when we dealt with informants, they were not only were they screened, but they were given numbers. They were registered. And any time an informant went out with any of our people, we always had two police officers at all times, number one. So that's a very important thing, and how, you know, each department does things slightly different. But, I mean, the points the lieutenant made was right on the money. Now, you got to keep in mind that overall drug enforcement in the United States at all levels is basically a big myth, because the overwhelming amount of drugs come into the United States where it is used and sold. So going after low-level street dealers is only a Band-Aid approach to a much larger problem.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, my last point, and I'm going to get off, is that the thug rap culture sends the wrong message to young minorities. And this is why we're dealing with the problems that we're dealing with.
Nick, so, can I ask you one thing as
yes,
a retired sergeant? The
yeah.
The caller, Ben, who was busted for drugs and ultimately did not inform on the person who sold him the drugs, he said there would be much less violence on the streets of our cities if drugs weren't illegal, because the drugs themselves obviously are bad things, but where so much of this violence comes from is from the fact that it's a black market, and so you get these turf wars and things like that. From your experience, how much do you agree with that?
I agree with that partially. They tried decriminalizing certain drugs. I think marijuana certainly has been decriminalized in some states. And there's been some success, but then other people will argue that marijuana is a gateway drug to other drugs. And the problem is that we're an addictive society that needs drugs and shouldn't be involved with them in the first place. And that includes alcohol and all these associated abuses that go with alcohol. You know, I did this for over 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a huge problem. It's a social problem. It's a socioeconomic problem. And it's a cultural problem.
But nobody's shooting up the streets anymore over beer or whiskey.
Well, no, that's true. You know, we tried prohibition, and that was a miserable failure, and it caused a lot of deaths, and it caused a lot of chaos. But
right.
There are certain differences. I mean, you can't – I don't think you should have it where a person could just go down to a drugstore and get a needle and then shoot up, heroin.
Right.
Because heroin itself is risky.
Nick, thanks a lot for calling.
But
call
thanks.
Us again.
Have a good new year.
You too.
Thank you.
And is that where you want to go, ultimately, since you write so much about the drug laws?
I think what we need to do is really just look, you know, at this whole system. I mean, since the mid to late 80s, we have pursued an extraordinarily punitive form of drug enforcement. The United States is now the world's leading incarcerator. We have about 7 million people in the United States under some form of correctional supervision now. I don't think this is the way to pursue the drug problem. You know, at the same time, we have allocated, you know, very, very, you know, few resources for rehabilitation. The demand end of the drug game, you know, in terms of reducing demand for drugs, just hasn't been tried in the way it needs to be. So I think this sort of policy is a failure.
My guest, Ethan Brown, author of the book Snitch, Informants, Cooperators, and the Corruption of Justice, published by Public Affairs Books. In 5 minutes, we're going to have a call-in for Pakistani Americans. We're going to give you some updates, first of all, on the situation in Pakistan. The government there is making some pretty interesting claims following the death of Benazir Bhutto. We will bring you up to date on that and then have a call in for Pakistani Americans again today on anything you want to say, as well as who for you is the next Benazir Bhutto, who should take her place in that January 8th election at the head of her party's ticket, if anyone. But let's get in one more call for Ethan Brown, and it's Athena in Queens. Athena, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Thank you. Good morning. There are thousands of women who are in jail because their husbands and boyfriends who are involved in drugs implicate them, and sometimes falsely, just so that the husband and boyfriend can get a lesser sentence, and these women get stiffer sentences, and many of them are languishing in prison falsely. Many of them resort to asking for presidential pardons, which never come. And it's part of what the author's complaint is, that these criminals implicate other people. They get off with much lesser sentence than these women. Many of them, falsely, are in jail.
Do you know about anything like that, Ethan?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's correct. And I think, you know, unfortunately, what happens a lot, and again, I'm speaking specifically about the federal system, is that you have a, you know, you take a drug conspiracy that's indicted, and you know, the individual or individuals who do not cooperate face the steepest sentence, regardless of their culpability in that drug conspiracy. So it sort of turns drug enforcement on its head, and that the least culpable person in a drug conspiracy gets the longest sentence because he or she does not cooperate.
Tying, and Athena, thank you for your call, tying the themes of your two books together, do you think the Don't Snitch movement means to hip-hop hustlers, as you call them, what it means to you?
No, I mean, and I think, you know, the Don't Snitch movement has become sort of so trendy and widespread and dangerously so that it's interpreted in a wide number of ways. One person can interpret it as meaning that, you know, criminals who are arrested shouldn't snitch on other criminals. And yet another person will interpret it as, you know, the everyday person on the street shouldn't go to the cops if they witness a crime. So, you know, there's an enormously wide variation of what, you know, stop snitching or don't snitch means.
And by the way, you're a white dude, I gather. How'd you get so interested in black street culture?
You know, it honestly started when I began writing about street crime, you know, many years ago at when I was at Details magazine and New York magazine for a while, and it just became sort of a fascinating thing to me, particularly because it's such a kind of vastly undercovered subject. I mean, there's a lot of writing about the mafia, but there's very little writing about this stuff, so it just seemed fascinating to me.
Journalist Ethan Brown, his new book is Snitch, Informants, Cooperators, and the Corruption of Justice. Very interesting stuff. Thanks a lot for coming
Thanks,
on with
Brian.
Us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute. As I said, we'll give you the latest on the situation in Pakistan, some perhaps surprising announcements coming from the government there just in the last little bit, and we'll have a call-in for Pakistani Americans. Is there a next Benazir Bhutto out there? Call us now, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692.